Brigadier Vickers, Reel 1. When did you first hear that you were going to be sent to Korea?
I'm not terribly sure about the date, but I think it was the 10th of April, 1951. I was sitting in my office at the Staff College. I was then head of the administrative team, and I was just finishing off a brand new core administrative exercise when my telephone rang, and it was a voice said, "Bill, Commandant here, come and see me." So I went to see him. My conscience was clear, and I walked into General Dudley's office, and he looked at me and said, "I think you better sit down." And I thought, God, what's happened now? And he said, "What I am going to tell you is top secret, and you're not to tell anybody, not even your wife. We have decided to set up a Commonwealth Division in Korea, and you're going out to be the AQ, and you've got to set up divisional headquarters in this country, and you've got to be in Tokyo in 17 days. Any questions?" There were no questions. That was how I first heard. And what did I know about Korea? Well, naturally, at the Staff College, we'd follow the Korean battle, which had then, war, which had then been going on for what, I suppose, seven or eight months. And we had pals out there, and I'd had a letter from Korea. And one realized that it was a very tough war in a tough country against a tough enemy. And it appeared to be a very hard infantry battle. I knew that from the Middlesex, with whom I had a certain amount of dealings. I didn't know much about Korea. I'd looked it up on the map. I knew that the weather was extreme. It seemed to be a hell of a long way from everywhere. And I remember people used to use the expression that they objected to going to war by proxy, which was what they felt about Truman's decision.
Did you have any strong feelings about it yourself?
No, I didn't. I admired the American decision to say to the North Koreans, the Greek Chinese, thus far and no further. When they went further, the American reaction. And it wasn't until I'd been in Korea sometime that I really began to appreciate the courage of that decision, because I think I'm right in saying they had the 34th Division, I could be wrong there, US Army on garrison duties in Tokyo and Japan, and they were literally uprooted in 48 hours and sent to Korea. Now, in 1950, if you could imagine uprooting a division from Germany with all their comforts and way of life that we had there, and pitching them into a very hostile and dangerous environment and a very tough war, it was some undertaking, because they were not trained or equipped, and they were green, and they were living in extreme luxury in Japan. And yet the president took the decision, and the United States Army reacted, and they were, in fact, in action in about 48, 72 hours. And I think people should realize that. It really was a very gutsy reaction. I think I regarded the war as something a long way away, which probably wouldn't affect me. But I was a regular soldier when I was told to go there. My reaction was that it was probably a great chance, if I was ambitious, because it was obviously going to be a tremendous task to set up a division at that distance. And so I was, militarily, I was keen to go. On the domestic side, with my wife and four children, I was dismayed at 17 days, but that's another story. We managed to solve it.
When were you allowed to tell your wife that you were going off to the Far East?
About 10 days before I went, which enabled me to buy a house at an exorbitant price in Camberley and to arrange for her to move and so on and so forth. I was able to do the basic administrative planning for the family. And they stayed in Camberley, and the children's schooling was all right, and there were lots of friends there. And we bought a rather inadequate little house at short notice for a vast sum of money. So that was all right, but it was quite a joke to the domestic system.
Could you give some idea of the duties of an AA and QMG as they were then taught at the staff college?
I think that's a very wide question, but yes, the teaching was that the AA and QMG was the divisional commander's advisor and executive officer on all matters dealing with administration of a division in the field in the widest sense, that is, the movement, the maintenance, the whole of the personnel problem of reinforcement and all the personnel services, directing and controlling the services, I mean the RASC, the RAOC and the REME and the medical and everything, supporting the services, keeping an eye on the performance of each brigade down to units through the command structure. You were the housekeeper for the divisional commander, and you had to work hand in glove with the G1. It was mostly a question of provision and forward thinking to enable the general staff to do operationally what they wanted to do. And considerable emphasis was laid upon the responsibility of the AQ to warn the command element if the operational plans couldn't be met by the administrative support. It was all a bit theoretical and so on and so forth, but a very good framework of a system of administrative control, and I use the word command within a division. But of course the great thing was that at the Star College, Cambridge, the teaching was that you had behind you a nice benevolent British Corps headquarters, which probably had an army headquarters, and the AQ could look forward all the time, because there'd be some very experienced chap looking after his rather administrative organisation to keep the division in full fighting trim. Administrative teaching at the Staff College was considered a necessity, but a slight drudge compared to the excitements of the general staff making appreciations and doing all these sort of things. But it was well taught, and the commandant and the G1s were quite insistent that anybody to be a properly trained staff officer in the field had to understand in detail the mechanics of the administration of a division in the field. And I think, perhaps I'm biased, I think it was very well taught in detail.
So if one might sum it up, it amounts to logistic management and also personnel management.
Yes. You can examine and teach or direct logistic management of the field, which you're dealing with things. The personnel side is a bit more difficult. You can talk about reinforcement rates and wastage rates and so on and so forth, but you can't get down to problems and morale because you've got nothing to deal with. It's all imaginary. I did find in Carrera that the personnel side was more complicated and more difficult than the logistic side, which in itself was bad enough in Carrera. But let me say that having been an AQ before, but not of a division, in a static organisation, and having been 2.5 years at the Staff College, I rarely felt complete confidence going out to Carrera that I could tackle the job. I knew enough to do it, and I had complete confidence to do it, and I was absolutely right. I'm not boasting. I was absolutely right. The teaching at the Staff College was ideal.
You do mention that when you got to Carrera, there were certain variations from the norm as taught at Staff College, which presumably was based upon European experience.
Well, I've been thinking about that. Yes, there were variations, because we were a single division. When we got there, there wasn't a division. There were three brigades. There was the Canadian Infantry Brigade Group, which had been there about 3 months. There was the Kansas Force 29, which had come out from UK, which was a brigade group, which had been there for 6 or 7 months. And then there was the original 28 Brigade that went in from Hong Kong, which was a Commonwealth Brigade with Australian infantry and New Zealand gunners. And they were, in fact, fighting as independent brigades in three different divisional areas in Korea. And we took out the heads of services and bits and pieces to make up a division and a divisional headquarters and a beefed up squadron of signals to do divisional communications to the brigades and backwards and so on and so forth. And these had to be assembled in UK and put on a ship and shipped out and so on at very short notice. And the first job in Korea was to decide on a date when the division was going to come into being, to prise them out from under American command, which I know was very difficult, but eventually we did it, and my memory is that we had a parade on the 1st of June 51 when the division was put into action. But it was rather like getting three independent feudal robber barons together who were terribly independent, and so were their staffs, and moulding them into a division. And that took about 3 months. The variations were that behind us we had a little forward base, I suppose it was, in Seoul, and then the whole of the LSC going back there was the responsibility of British Commonwealth forces in Korea. They had a base organisation in Pusan, and they had a fairly major organisation in Kyrie, which was based on the original Commonwealth forces of occupation in Japan. But they were three static headquarters. All the movement was controlled by the Americans, and we were equipped, of course, with a variety of equipment. We had British equipment, the Australians had their own varieties, the Canadians had even greater, wider variety. We had an Indian parachute field ambulance who required certain specialised, chiefly rations. New Zealand field artillery regiment, they had special things. So there wasn't a nice solid British LFC sending out British goods. There was a huge variety. And it's astonishing how emotional a New Zealand soldier can get if you don't give him his pinched kiwi hat. He really gets very temperamental. And that hat has to come from New Zealand, and it's got to be bought up through this extraordinary international chain of communications. And I think my feeling was that it is almost an administrative nonsense. And extremely expensive to put a British force into an American army theatre of operations and not give it American equipment and give it American support, because we were extremely wasteful, very expensive, and I shudder to think how many millions were thrown away when peace eventually came and we ran down the base, so on and so forth. As you can imagine, the base was full of hundreds, nay, thousands of tons of unwanted equipment, which was given away. The other thing was that an AQO division should never have to look over his shoulder. This was the teaching at Camberley, but of course that wasn't the same in Korea. And quite honestly, it got down to the sort of situation when I had a staff captain who kept a map where the ships were. One thing we were terribly dependent upon was our vehicles, and I might as well tell the story of the vehicles. The Bedford didn't stand up very well to the roads in Korea, which were extremely bad, and we were only getting about 4,000 to 5,000 miles out of a Bedford QL, and then they had to be shipped down to Singapore to be reconditioned and rebuilt. So there had to be a special influx into Singapore of spares and engines and what have you from UK. And this took too long, and the result of the rebuild in Singapore was very unsatisfactory, and we had to modify the vehicles and so on and so forth. And we conceived the idea of setting up a vehicle rebuilding effort in Japan. And we looked at this, and of course the thing was dead easy. There were the whole Kyori Naval Shipyards there, enormous great workshops doing nothing. And in literally no time at all, with the willing cooperation of COD Donington, who shipped the stuff direct out to Japan, in about 4 months we started the most efficient vehicle rebuilding line in Kyori, and you could get... They had enough vehicles there that when you sent back an LST load of clapped out old Bedford Cures to be rebuilt, before you... the LST coming in would give you the new vehicles. Back went the old ones. And within 3 weeks, they'd be back on the line in the vehicle park. And that was one of the great successes. And the Japanese force that did it there was superb. That was... Now, the AQ of the division was deeply involved in that because he couldn't be dismounted for lack of vehicles and so on and so forth. That was one thing. The other thing was that our artillery supply, 25-pounder, 4.2 and 3-inch mortar ammunition, was peculiar to the British. And we used artillery there at a very high rate of striking. And I can remember in November when we were considerably... We were involved in heavy fighting about the time Speakman got his VC. We were considering doing a fairly major brigade plus attack on the western end of the Commonwealth Division line, where we had joined the Marines, because the real estate, as the Americans called it, that we were holding was not the best. And I can remember having to say in the planning conference with the divisional commander and the CRA and the G1 and the CRE that I simply couldn't produce the ammunition and it wouldn't be there, and that I wouldn't dare say that we'd got the ammunition until we'd actually got it on land in Korea, and then you were pretty sure to within 24 hours when it would arrive. But there simply wasn't enough ammunition to support an attack, and the inevitable counterattack and the length of the intense activity phase, which might have lasted 7, perhaps 10 days, and you would want up to 300 plus rounds per gun per day, and that's some fair tonnage of ammunition, and that was on the high seas.
Presumably, if you were firing at that rate, you'd also require barrel linings and other gun spares.
Well, that's another thing we had to do. We had to get up, in fact, 16 pieces modified, which we kept in our, which the LFC kept just south of Seoul. But the New Zealand Field Regiment, fairly soon after I got there, had more or less blown their barrels clean, and so we told GHQ Far East in Singapore that we wanted a complete set of 26 guns sent up, and they agreed, and the programme was made. Again, the AQ looking over his shoulder. And the great day came when the LST was going to arrive in Incheon with the guns, and the Americans very gallantly relieved 16 New Zealand Field Regiment RA and put in a 105 Regiment US Army, who were very good. And they slotted into our system and to our fire control system. And I remember going down to Incheon with the New Zealanders who were going to tow the guns away. We were going to put them into a little practice camp we had for 3 days just to get them shaken down. Then they'd relieve the Americans. Quite a simple thing to do, but it involved, you know, thinking down to Singapore. The LST came in and the ramps went down. And I was standing next to Dick Good, the creamy, and the ramp went down, and a New Zealand quad went in, and it pulled out the first gun, and I couldn't believe it. It hadn't even got a muzzle brake on it. So we stopped the first gun and looked at it, and Dick said, "This gun is a 1942 gun, which has not been modified to fire in the upper register," or whatever the technical term was. And he looked at it, and he looked round it, and he had an expert with him who said, "Well, it'll take me at least 4 weeks back at the base workshops in Curie to bring this gun up to operational requirements." So we didn't unload, we put the one thing back, and we sent it back to Curie. What do you do? I mean, this is gross inefficiency by a major base. And when the commander-in-chief was told about this, I mean, there were spots. And this happened several times, that the base stocks in Singapore had been put there after the war and had not been supervised, and they hadn't been updated, they hadn't been brought up to date, and so on and so forth. And we had that with wireless equipment and so on and so forth. And that's the sort of thing. The AQ never looks over his shoulder, but that was the sort of local variation.
You mentioned the impact of local conditions on the Bedfords. How did the tanks that we had out there stand up to Korean conditions?
We had Centurions in the armoured regiment. We had an independent squadron of Churchill crocodile flamethrowers, but we phased them out fairly soon. I think there was no problem. I think they performed very well. They hadn't got a great deal of track mileage. Of course, the time I got there, it was a pretty static battle. We did advance some 25 miles, but there was none of the war of movement there had been up to then. So there was not a great deal of pressure on the tanks, but I think mechanically they performed very well. I don't remember any problem. But the wear and tear on vehicles was extraordinary in those appalling conditions of great heat and great cold and bad roads and bad weather. The drivers did a good job out there. Of course, the other local variation was being under command of an American corps, which was a complete eye-opener to me. I knew a good deal about the American Army. We had studied the problem at Camberley. My battalion, actually, in the war had been under command, or my brigade in the war had been under command of an American division in late 44 in the Aachen battle, and one had seen Americans, and I knew how their army worked in theory, but the Americans haven't got the slightest idea how the British army worked or what it was. And this led to all sorts of extraordinary things, because you would get an absolutely unintelligible gobbledygook signal or letter from your corps headquarters asking for a return of equipment that you didn't have, and so on and so forth. And when you went down there and you said to the full colonel, who was the G4, I'm 6'6", my American chief was 6'8½". He was a charming man. But when I said to him, "Look, we don't have Browning machine guns," he said, "But goddamn, all infantry battalions have Browning machine." I said, "No, we have our own light automatic weapons, Bren guns." "Gee, do you really? Can you let me have a list of how many guns you've got?" I said, "What do you want that for? You're not in the thing." And they simply didn't realise that the Commonwealth Division was equipped with British equipment. They'd never taken the trouble to find out. And I must say, I was not impressed with their staff work. Their orders were unintelligible, and never did I feel more acutely that the greatest problem to Anglo-American cooperation in the field is the so-called common language. It's not. It is a very different language. But they were fun, and they were very helpful, and I must say this, they really did once the division had got there, they did a great deal to help us in their own peculiar way. And I always remember, it was in early 52, we had a pretty nasty attack came in on the Canadian Brigade and a bit on the KOSB and KSLI. And it was a very noisy night. And we saw the Chinese off, as we always did. And I remember the Corps commander came up, not the next day, the day after, and he was just passing through, and he got out of his helicopter and said to the divisional commander, "I just thought I'd let you know, Jim, that when they woke me up the night before last and said that the Chinese 27th Corps, whatever it was attacking the Commonwealth Division, I said, 'Poor bloody Chinese,' and rolled over and went to sleep, because I was happy that nothing would happen." And that was a great compliment, and they did trust us, and they were great fun to work with, but, oh God, they do waste men and material. Their system is peculiar.
What did you think of their fighting qualities as opposed to their staff work?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. Let me start at the top. We were on the extreme western flank when we arrived there, on the main thrust line into Seoul. The Americans paid us the compliment of putting the Commonwealth Division on the main thrust line, which was the road down to Seoul. When we first arrived, we had on our left, between us and the sea, we had the Republic of Korea Capital Division, which was their super elite formation, which was a pretty good formation. And then they were relieved by the famous 1st U.S. Marine Division, and we were delighted to have the U.S. Marines on our left. And they were, I suppose the reputation was that they were the elite of the ground forces of the whole American system. They were very surprising. There were an awful lot of them. They were very dirty, very tough, enormous amount of equipment, and they died. So many of them died unnecessarily. The U.S. Marines never give up real estate, and they would counterattack totally unnecessary for quite unimportant little bump in the ground. And they would never trade real estate. And they were extremely aggressive. And it was not a very good country to be aggressive in unless you did it on a big scale. I thought they fought very well. I hope this doesn't go to American sources, but I reckon that if you took American soldiers out of their system and trained them in ours with British officers, they really would be absolutely first class. They were very brave, physically tough. And what is interesting, that they rarely believed in what they were fighting for. Our national servicemen out there, who did a wonderful job, were there because they were there. The Americans were there because they were fighting communism in Korea. And this stood out a mile all the time. It was a very interesting difference. I had a great respect for the American fighting man. He's very brave, he's very tough. He's needlessly uncomfortable, and he can't look after himself. And I think his training is unbelievable. And this I saw later on in Vietnam.